Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Previously on the Philosopher's Zone.
I think what's distinctive about science in the West is that it's built up a cumulative program, at least from the early 17th century. And I think that one way in which it's able to do this is that it manages to establish itself as the canon of rationality. Now, this is much disputed, but it's a struggle that it effectively won, at least up to the middle of the 20th century. At least up to the middle of the 20th century, there was a very dominant idea that science encapsulates the basic canons of rationality.
Hi, I'm Alan Saunders. This is the summer season of the Philosopher's Zone, and that was Stephen Gaukroger, Professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. He's the author of The Emergence of a Scientific Culture, Science and the Shaping of Modernity. And that's what we're returning to this week, beginning with the question, why did all this happen in the West, rather than, say, ancient China or the medieval Islamic world?
Well, there's a standard kind of Weberian view about that's to say, deriving from Max Weber, the great sociologist, which is that Islamic culture and Chinese culture in particular are distinctively different from Western culture. In China, one had a very well-organized network so that scientific results could be transmitted very easily. But there were severe restrictions on innovation in Chinese science.
This is the great Confucian bureaucratic structure
exactly.
of China.
The bureaucratic structure has a great defect and it has a great advantage. The great advantage is the ability to communicate one's results. The great disadvantage is that it discourages innovation and novelty. By contrast, the medieval Islamic cultures had the opposite problem. There were very few constraints on novelty and innovation, but there was no organized structure of any kind. So one was responsible to one's mullah, and with a little bit of exception in the case of medicine and maybe law, there was no way of communicating those results to others. The Weberian view is that this changed with the so-called investiture controversy in the West. And what happened in the investiture controversy is that the state and the church carved up responsibilities between themselves.
Now, we're going back a long way,
aren't we?
This is, yes. What, 1050, isn't
it? This is
it?
1050, it starts. Yes. In the 11th and the 12th centuries, there's a decision to carve up responsibilities. So intellectual and spiritual life belong to the church, politics and state matters belong to the sovereign. And what happens in this is that the church forms itself as a corporation. It has limited responsibilities, but it has complete control over those. And in the wake of the church forming itself as a corporation, various other bodies started to form themselves as corporations, guilds, towns, and crucially, universities. So the Weberian view is that you get this new corporate structure, the university. It's sympathetic to innovation. It doesn't constrain innovation on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a neutral realm of inquiry. Neither the church nor the state can interfere in it. So you've got innovation and you've got communication. And it's this unit, this kind of molecular unit, that gives the West its distinct cultural form whereby intellectual inquiry can flourish. But by the time you get to the 16th and early 17th century, much scientific work is being done outside universities because scientific work's often done under systems like patronage, which are shared with Islamic and Chinese cultures to some extent. So I don't think there is that big difference.
Well, let's look at why it wasn't happening in universities. And perhaps to do that, we can go back to the very beginning of your book and to the year 1210. Mm. What was important about the year 1210?
What was important about the year 1210 was that Aristotle was being introduced into the universities. So Aristotle's work was becoming known, particularly at the University of Paris, and really everything hinges on the University of Paris. It's the kind of world university of the time. Every philosopher and theologian of note studies or teaches at Paris. And Aristotle's work, which is a secular philosophy, was in conflict on certain basic issues with traditional Christian teaching, like whether the world was eternal, whether the soul was immortal, were the two main issues. Medieval theologians had decided a couple of centuries earlier that they wanted to provide some kind of foundation for Christian belief, that it wasn't simply a question of faith. So to convert Muslims, Jews, heathens, others, they started formulating their theological beliefs in philosophical terms designed to convince people who didn't share the same sacred texts that they did. And they were also concerned about heresy, and they thought if you have a clear philosophical formulation, just in terms of reason, if you can formulate Orthodox Christian doctrine just in terms of reason, then you can show exactly what's wrong with various heretical views, and you can convince those who don't share the same sacred texts. For various reasons, the philosophical systems that they had available to them, which were very mixed, turned out such that Platonism, which had traditionally provided the foundation for Christianity, was not adequate to the formulation of fundamental Christian views like the Trinity, the Incarnation, things that were regarded as central to Christian belief. But now, Aristotelianism did provide the basis for this.
Now, we should explain that Plato was Aristotle's teacher.
That's right.
But Aristotle moves in very different directions, including doing a lot of natural science, doing a lot of observation, not always very accurate, of the natural world.
Exactly. The Platonist view was that knowledge is not of particular sensible things, but of what Plato called forms, which are things removed from sensation. And that in some sense you've got to transcend mere sensory appearances and get to the ultimate reality. Aristotle's view, by contrast, was that all knowledge derives from sensation. All non-revelatory knowledge, anyway. There's revelation and there's sensation. And the philosophy that Aristotle built on this turned out to be much more conducive to the defense of a number of basic Christian doctrines than Platonism. However, by the 13th century, when Aristotle's works were being introduced, it turned out that although Aristotelianism had this advantage, it also had disadvantages in that certain Christian doctrines, immortality of the soul and the eternity of the world, were not consistent with Aristotelianism. And here I think for the first time you get a distinctively modern clash between two fundamental systems, both of which lay claim to a kind of comprehensive understanding of the world. And I think this is quite new in the 13th century. And the responses to this, the various kinds of response to this clash, shape Western culture throughout the Middle Ages and the early modern period. And one of the most important things they do is they put science or natural philosophy at the centre of the issue of understanding the world, which it certainly wasn't prior to that. So now, for the first time in the West, our general understanding of the world and our understanding of our place in the world come to hinge on science or natural philosophy. And that's why 1210 is a really crucial date for me. It's not the origins of modern science, but it is the origins of a culture in which science takes on a role that it didn't have previously.
Nonetheless, Aristotle's teacher Plato does make a reappearance in the history of ideas, and he does that in the Renaissance. So what's going on there?
By the 16th century, and to some extent by the 15th century, there's a lot of criticism of Aristotle. The principal response to the clash between science and religion at the beginning of the 13th century was that these could be bridged. And this was the response of Thomas Aquinas.
The great doctor of the church.
Great doctor
Saint
of
Thomas
the church.
Aquinas, yes.
Aquinas thought that you could bridge revelation and theology on the one hand and knowledge based on sense perception, science, natural philosophy on the other. He didn't think it was easy, but he thought of the discipline of metaphysics as being something that was neutral, and this is a real innovation on his part, being neutral with respect to both theology on the one hand and natural philosophy or science on the other. And it's a bit like many modern analytic philosophers will talk about reconciling science and common sense through these neutral means of metaphysics. So that's just another version of this very distinctive 13th century project. By the 15th and 16th centuries, it's becoming clear that this reconciliation just wasn't going to work. And various other options were being sought out. A revival of Platonism was one option that was taken up, though it was comparatively short-lived. A very radical form of naturalism, so-called, that went back to the very earliest philosophers and saw the source of all activity in nature rather than in God. A very radical form of philosophy also turned out not to work for all kinds of reasons. And by the end of the 16th century, there was a sense that the traditional options were not going to work. And that's when we get the emergence of a new conception of natural philosophy, of nature and the rest of it.
But also the notion that the traditional options aren't going to work, that also presumably is what marginalises the universities, because they're teaching Aristotelianism.
They are indeed, and they're teaching it up to the 18th century in many cases. Really, you've got to look to Holland in the late 17th century for the beginnings of anti-Aristotelian movements in the universities. In the main, they're not the harbingers of the new work in science that's being done. But that's complicated because you get people making large claims for natural philosophy, and one can have some sympathy with the critics of those claims in the universities. So it isn't black and white, certainly.
Well, the large claims for natural philosophy are going to get larger as we move into the 20th century. The principal cheerleaders for science then were a bunch of philosophers who started out in Vienna called the logical positivists. Their commanding idea was that a statement was meaningful if it was possible to say how that statement could be verified. What's happening on the dark side of the moon? Well, I don't know, but I do know how statements about what's happening there could be verified. You just go there and check it out. On the other hand, statements about religion and morality, well, they're not really verifiable, and therefore not the sort of thing that logical positivists were keen on. Science, the realm of the verifiable, was what mattered to them. And in different ways, it was what mattered to their arch-enemy, Karl Popper. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Stephen Gaukroger about the emergence of science in Western culture. And before we get on to the logical positivists, let's look at what Gaukroger calls the change in the persona of the natural philosopher, which he says occurred in the 17th century. What does he mean by the persona, and what was the change?
Well, the persona is a way of trying to capture what it is to be a philosopher or a natural philosopher in cultural terms without respect to the particular content of doctrines. So, a statesman, a theologian, and a philosopher may, all three of them, argue about certain moral and political questions. And an issue here arises as to the standing of each of these. The theologian and the statesman and the philosopher have a particular standing which is independent of the particular doctrine that they enunciate. They are, if you like, entitled to a view or entitled to make a claim to a certain area in virtue of being a philosopher or in virtue of being a theologian or in virtue of being a statesman. And this idea of you have entitlement to speak or to be heard in virtue of being a philosopher is captured in the idea of the persona of the philosopher. One thing I want to argue is that the reshaping of the persona of the natural philosophy in the 17th century is crucial to the establishment of science or natural philosophy more generally at the centre of Western culture. And in a sense, this is my alternative to the way Popper does it. Popper thinks that you can do it in terms of methodology. I'm saying, no, it's a much more complex question. It's a cultural question. And the issue is, how does the persona of the scientist come to be shaped by the 18th century? So that there's a shift from someone who has technical expertise but otherwise might be quite marginal, to someone who is a bearer of the standards of rationality of our culture. And you can't explain that in terms of the success of the content of particular scientific doctrines. You can't do that partly because the same thing happens when you compare it with other scientific cultures. You get success, but you don't get any corresponding change in the persona of the natural philosopher. They're still regarded as people who have a technical expertise, but that's it. Whereas in the West, what happens is that people who have a technical expertise, almost in virtue of that, are transformed into something quite different as to bearers of the kind of standards of cognitive legitimacy, rationality, and the rest of it. So that's how I deal with what you might think of as the Popper problem. It's crucial to understanding how it is that science takes on the kind of role that it does in the West.
So we see a distinction emerging, do we, between the natural philosopher, whom we would now call a scientist, and the speculative philosopher, who are the sort of people that we now think of as philosophers.
Not in the 17th century. In broad terms, one sees that in the 18th century, but it's complicated. The person who establishes science as being the bearer of general standards of rationality and culture, the first person who did this really is Voltaire in his Lettres Philosophiques, which came out in the 1730s.
This was published, I think, originally in English in 1727 as the Letters Concerning the English Nation.
He wrote them, that's right. He wrote them when he was in England. And then there's a revised, more radical version that came out in France, that's right. Now, Voltaire was not a natural philosopher. He was not a scientist. Yet, he put scientific values at the centre of culture. I mean, he's the first one to say these are the cultural standards that we should adhere to in judging religion and other things. And what he shapes is what's sometimes called the philosoph, this Enlightenment philosopher who is, or Enlightenment thinker, who is an advocate of standards of rationality drawn, as they believe, from science rather than from anywhere else. And the way in which it happens, of course, is very complicated, but it has effects for this division between the scientist and the non-scientist, because the non-scientist is now not just someone who doesn't do science. It can be someone who doesn't do science, but who feels entitled to comment on the standing of science, and someone who feels competent to interpret what goes on in science as a model for other kinds of activity.
It's interesting, though, that our distinction between the philosopher and the scientist is one that, in a lot of university curricula, is projected backwards
into
the past. So that Descartes, you are likely to encounter, unless you're a mathematician, there's a special category if you're a mathematician, but basically you're likely to encounter his Meditations or his discourse on method, and not what he would have thought of, this is in the middle of the 17th century, not what he would have thought of as his most important work, what he thought of himself as doing.
True, and not what his contemporaries would have thought of him. I mean, Descartes devised a cosmological system in the 1630s and 1640s that was the standard system of the universe until Newton. And for many continental philosophers who actually were at the cutting edge of these questions until the 1720s, 1730s, it was the standard cosmological system. It was the first real general competitor to Aristotle, and it was eclipsed only towards the middle of the 18th century, completely eclipsed towards the middle of the 18th century by Newton. He was an innovator in physiology. He's usually regarded as the person who discovered the reflex arc. He was a very major contributor to optics. He discovered the sine law of refraction. And he spent 5 or 6 years devising lens grinding machines. He put a room in his house to one side. He tells you how he's reinforced the beams, how it's got 15 or 16 moving parts. He's experimenting with different kinds of leather for polishing lenses. So all the people who are regarded as philosophers in the 17th century, so far as I know, have an active engagement with science. Spinoza less so than others, but he made a living as a lens grinder. So
this is the great Jewish philosopher.
This is the great Jewish philosopher,
yes.
The great radical philosopher of the 17th century. Leibniz was a great mathematician, inventor of calculus, had a cosmological system as well.
And Thomas Hobbes, the 17th century mm-hmm. English philosopher, certainly engaged in scientific dispute, didn't he?
He did. He had a theory of optics. He had a theory of mechanics. He had views about mathematics that he argued with mathematicians about. So these were part and parcel of the same enterprise. If you think of philosophy generally as understanding the world and our place in it, then of course it's quite natural that you would include all these activities in it.
It's interesting, there's a passage in the autobiography of A.J. Ayer, the 20th century British philosopher and logical positivist, whom, having written his book Language, Truth and Logic, which basically says that science is the only way to go, he then of course realises that having had a standard Oxford education of his time, he doesn't actually know any science. Mm. So he sort of hangs around laboratories, tries to teach himself a bit, but really doesn't get very far. Whereas for the guys you're talking about, certainly Hobbes and Descartes and Leibniz, the fact that natural philosophy is becoming much more quantitative, it's all about measuring things, it's about mathematics, that isn't really going to trouble them, is it?
No, it's not. And I think the modern view, the people who think science tells you everything, are almost always people who've never done any science. Because I think you can really only seriously propose that if you have a completely theoretical understanding of science. I think anyone who's had any connection with practical science realizes that science is not this kind of inverted pyramid with your basic principles at the bottom and everything following on from them. It's much more messy than that. It's, you know, the idea that you can explain the simplest macroscopic physical object in terms of the behavior of atoms is just not something that's on the cards in serious science. It's a much, much messier, more complex business. And many, many scientists, and these days many philosophers of science, are moving much more towards non-reductionist views, that there are many different kinds of activity in science. And the best one can do, maybe, is to bridge them, but you certainly can't reduce them. A man called Peter Galison at Harvard wrote a book called Image and Logic, where he looks at microscopic physics since the Second World War. And he devotes a lot of detailed attention to just how you bridge the different disciplines. And the bridging is very, very limited. There's no sense that you have this single discipline of microphysics. There's all these different things that you make, one-off connections, and it's quite fascinating, and it's a really good antidote to the idea that there is this single thing, science, and it tells you about everything.
Well, that's one message we can take away. Another message that perhaps Richard Dawkins can take away from your book is that the rise of science is not about science dissociating itself from religion.
Certainly, certainly, certainly. I think quite the contrary. I think a lot of the motivation for developments in science in the 17th century, particularly in the late 7th century, are driven by developments in natural theology. That's to say, particularly in England, for example, and this is a view to which Newton was very sympathetic, the idea is that you have these two sources of knowledge, still unreconciled from the beginning of the 13th century, namely religion and science, and the thing to do is to triangulate them so that you can sort out the wheat from the chaff. And the idea is that there is just a single truth. Both these discourses aim at truth, so let's triangulate them, get them fixed on the same thing so that we can work out what's true and what's false in each of them. And in the process, build up something that's much stronger than either of them taken individually.
Stephen Gaukroger, whose book The Emergence of a Scientific Culture, Science and the Shaping of Modernity, 1210 to 1685, is published by Oxford University Press. Details on our website. You've been listening to the summer series of The Philosopher's Zone with me, Alan Saunders, and the show is produced by Kyla Slavin, with technical production this week by John Diamond. And this has been the second in a two-part series on the emergence of science. So if you want to download last week's episode or read the programme's transcript, simply head to our website, abc.net.au/rn/philosopher's zone. Tune in next week and hear Tariq Ramadan on Islam and philosophy. Bye for now.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.